This message is supported by Boehringer Ingelheim, the maker of NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel Chewable Tablets. Next level dog owners will do anything for their pets, especially when it comes to their well-being. And that means giving them next level protection from parasites with NexGard Plus Chews. NexGard Plus Chews provide one and done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're designed to be easy to give in a tasty, beef-flavored soft chew. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventative. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus Chews.
And now it's time for the Sports Kings from Queens.
Mike, why am I out?
You're not a wartime consigliere, Tom. Things may get rough with the move we're trying.
I advise, Michael. I never thought you were a bad consigliere. I thought Santino was a bad Don. Rest in peace. Michael has all my confidence, as you do. But there are reasons why he must have no part in what is going to happen.
Maybe I could help.
You're out, Tom.
Greetings, sports fans. We are the Sports Kings from Queens. I'm Gino, joined by my co-hosts Kevin and Darren. Today is Wednesday, June 4th. This is episode 174. Please catch us wherever you get your podcasts. Like, subscribe, follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, follow us on YouTube. Give us a look, join our pages, send us a comment. If you got any questions, send it to us. Darren's always checking that stuff. He'll make sure to get back to you right away. Tonight, we go around the world of sports. We got some interesting things going on. We'll talk about the Belmont at the end. We're going to start it off with the Knicks. We did our eulogy on Saturday night after the last game had ended. But today, the Knicks are in the news because Tom Thibodeau has been fired. 5 years, he won 56% of his regular season games, 226-174 over five seasons. Fourth winningest coach in New York Knicks history. You know, he signed an extension last summer. I guess that extension meant nothing, except that he gets paid for another couple of years.
$30 million.
2021 season, that's year one. He lost round one to the Hawks. Year two, he missed the playoffs. Round three, lost in round two to the Heat. Year four, lost in round two to the Pacers. And then, of course, year five, which just happened, they lose in the Eastern Conference Finals to the Pacers. We talked about it on Saturday. Could this be a change, potential change that we could see? Kev, start it up.
Yeah, as we talked about Saturday night, it felt like this team needed a change to make that next leap. And with the contracts, with the lack of draft picks, with no salary cap space, the easiest change was the coach, and that's what happened. You know, Tibbs came in. I mean, he did a great job for the Knicks. I mean, this was a nothing franchise for the 20 years prior to him coming in. And the fact that he made the playoffs for the 5 years, in the last 3 years, got better and better every playoff run, back-to-back 50-win seasons. But one of the things that I think really encapsulates Tibbs, one stat just shows everything that's wrong with Tibbs. 579 winning percentage in his career, which is the highest of any coach to never coach in the NBA Finals. He is a guy that shows that he is a terrific regular season coach. He gets the most out of his team. But as we've seen all year, and as the one complaint we all had all year, was that he overplayed the starters. I mean, the Knicks were – all five starters were in the top five – were in the top – what, 20 or 25 of minutes played the whole season. And he doesn't make the in-game adjustments we feel like he needs to make. He's very rigid in his rotation, in his style of play. And I think when it comes playoff time, that gets exposed.
Not that just year, Kev. Not just year. Going back years.
Oh, years.
To the S at the end.
Like I said, nothing against Tibbs. I mean, he did a great job for the Knicks. He took them from nothing to a contender. Now we need a coach to get them from a contender to a championship. And we'll see if they get this higher right. Darren?
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, we talked about it on Saturday, and you're saying a lot of the things that I feel. Tibbs, in my opinion, had to go, and at the same point in time, it's an unfair firing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not fair. He's done everything right. Fact is that Tibbs is nearly 70 years old. Tibbs is not going to change his ways, whether he just believes in what he believes or he's just too stubborn to try to adjust the way he coaches. You know, this is a defensive coach coaching an offensive team that can never get into a set with less than more than 10 seconds to go in the shot clock against the Pacers, who are not known as a great defensive team. Nothing against Neesmith, but the rest of the guys are not exactly defensive stalwarts out there. And they, you know, the organization, and you hear different conflicting reports, whether it was Rose on his own, whether it was Dolan on his own, whether it was, I have to believe it was both of them in one way or another that got involved in this move.
It can't be just one or the other.
No,
right?
It's gotta be,
you know, it had to be both of them that just feel like, wow, our window is not that big. And we have to try to do what we can now. We don't have the draft picks in the future to build. So we have these guys while we can afford the contracts, and we have to try to make a move in like a 3-4 year period on the high end. And we think that Tibbs has done yeoman's work and gotten us to the precipice. And now we need that one guy, a game changer for us, someone that's going to make adjustments, someone that's going to make the offense more fluid or fun. And, you know, make it an offensive team that occasionally gets down there and buckles down for the big stop in the right spot. That's really what it comes down to. Again, great job by Tibbs. Much like you said, Kevin, I'm reiterating a lot of it. I think it was the right move. And yet at the same point in time, it's completely unfair to Tom Thibodeau. Yeah. Thibodeau, I should say. Jake?
Yeah.
So, although I don't want to take anything away from Tibbs, by the way. Okay, great job, 5 years, you know. He was the coach of the team that wasn't doing anything, couldn't make the playoffs, got to the playoffs for the 5 years. So I'm not taking anything away. It's also the players, though, obviously, and that is, you know, we didn't have some of these players that we have here playing for him now. And listen, we got into it on Saturday, and, you know, if a change needed to be made, we all kind of thought change had to get made. This is a change. Is it fair? No, it's probably not fair to him. He got a 3-year extension last year, got him to those, you know, Eastern Conference Finals, 2 games away from going to the finals, you know, and it's a shame Game 1 went that way in the Eastern Conference Finals, but it did. And Tibbs is gone. Is this the start of something else? Who the hell knows? You know, is there a star that said, I'm not coming there if Tibbs is the coach? Who knows? Okay, you know, and when I say that, I really mean, and I'm not saying I want him, but, you know, the rumor was maybe it's Durant who's saying that. I don't know. You know, but he's gone. We're going to move forward. You know, tip your hat to him. It's been a great 5 years, and, you know, the Knicks move on. Names that came out as potential candidates. So Mike Malone, Mike Budenholzer, and here you go, ready? Jeff Van Gundy, Jay Wright, Dan Hurley, Johnny Bryant, and then 2 current coaches who already have jobs, which got thrown around, which I heard was Jason Kidd and Ime Udoka. Listen, each one of those has some issues. I don't see Jay Wright coming back, but, you know.
Danny Hurley already dismissed it. He said he's not.
Yeah, Danny Hurley already dismissed it. I can't see Van Gundy coming back, but okay. You know, I won't go into 2 coaches that already have jobs, because who the hell knows with that. So, you know, at that point, if you just go by the list I gave you, you're down to Mike Malone and Mike Budenholzer. That basically, and Johnny Bryant, who apparently has a lot of momentum in getting one of these head coaching jobs. I'm not sure if I want someone who's never coached before to come in here to try to get you to the finals at this point. But yep, that's neither here nor there at the moment. Any you guys have anything on potential candidates?
We also hear Mike Brown, Frank Vogel, you know, guys who won some of the guys who have won championships, but they feel like retread picks. My initial thought was Malone, but when you really look at him, he is more of a defensive minded coach who plays a tight rotation and feels like Tibbs 2.0, even though he did win 2 years ago with Denver.
Yep.
And he's much younger.
And he's much younger. Right?
So
he's
maybe much younger. And he does relate well to players. And not saying Tibbs doesn't, but he does relate well to players.
You know, I was glad to hear somebody like Hurley say no, because I want to root for the Knicks. And if Hurley's a coach, I couldn't root for them.
Nice.
Jay Wright's interesting because of the Villanova connection with Hart and Brunson and
Bridges.
Thank you. Again, I don't know if he wants to coach in the pros. And he's never coached in the pros before, which, you know, you don't know about that.
I also don't think you can make this move, Kev, unless you have someone in mind that you think is going to get them to the next level, which eliminates the coaches that haven't coached before at this level.
Like Bryant.
Yeah, it takes Bryant out of it to me. And, you know, listen, you know, it leaves the first two guys you mentioned.
Yep.
And if you think you can get Kidd or you think you can get Udoka, that would be the other two choices. I don't see – even Brown has done some things if you want to take him as a retread. He had done a good job at Sacramento. Obviously, he did a good job at Cleveland. So, I mean, but you know, I think it's got to be a limited group. I don't think you can give a first-time coach an opportunity here you're making this move, when you're firing a guy that was highly successful for, you know, someone that you don't know what they're going to bring.
You're firing a coach of an Eastern Conference final.
Yep.
You're not going to downgrade a coach.
And pretty fast, too, by the way.
Yeah.
I thought this came very quickly. Again, I don't know if that means anything, but I thought this came really quick. And, you know, when you look at it, you know, what, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, you'd be throwing a party for him because you just beat the Celtics. You're going to the finals, the Eastern Conference finals, right? So, but anyway, any other thoughts about this, Darren?
I mean, not to me, like we said, move that had to be done. I want an established coach here. To be honest, if the coaching move doesn't work, Rose is gone.
Yep.
Leon Rose gets like a year with this new coach. Otherwise, he's gone. And he doesn't necessarily deserve to be gone either. He's done a pretty good job building it up. But he's the guy that made the Towns move. He's the guy that made the Bridges trade. Right? So when you make those type of moves, now – you are going to be out in the forefront.
That's it.
The guy that's going to be out in the forefront a little bit is Jalen Brunson. He's the star, okay? So he's going to have to take a little bit more pressure. And they need a coach that's going to try to take some of that pressure off of him, bringing it up and not just wearing the guy down. And, you know, I just want to get someone here that's established, that has won, and that can take what Tibbs did and get it to the next spot. And you got to hope that Rose has an idea of who that person is. Otherwise, this is a colossal error.
Yeah, I would actually agree with that.
Yep, 100%, Darren.
All right, so we got the NBA Finals coming up. Indiana, Oklahoma City. Kev, who you got?
Well, this should be a fairly high-scoring series based on what we've seen.
I would think.
You know, watching the Pacers play the Knicks, the Pacers want to push the pace, no pun intended. But OKC, like I said, plays – their defense drives this. They can turn you over. They can create so much offense off their defense. Similar to the Knicks-Pacers series, I think when you look at the individual matchups, you know, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is going to be the best player on the court, much like Jalen Brunson was. You can make a case that Williams might be the second best player on the court. I think the big difference is that OKC has Dort that they can play in Haliburton to slow him down, which is a big upgrade on defense from Brunson. And I think, you know, the fact that they're not going to be phased at all by the Pacers pushing the basketball or anything else like that, OKC is going to be able to keep up with them and outscore them. And I think OKC wins this pretty easily.
How many games, Kev?
I've got them in five.
Okay.
Darren?
Well, I had them in four, so I think we're not that far apart. No. I went with the actual sweep. The thing is that the Knicks actually forced turnovers on Indiana, and they're not nearly the defensive team that Oklahoma City is. I don't think Indiana can slow down OKC. I think OKC can slow down Indiana. Listen, I know Minnesota got a game from them. I just think that this is like something where they're going to taste it after getting the first two at home. I think Indiana's best chance to win a game is game one. If Indiana wins a game, I think it'll be game one. And I think that that would be the only one I think they could lose just because of the layoffs and getting everybody up and motivated again. And this is not an indictment on Indiana. They just are not going to get the open three looks that they got against the Knicks. And watching that series as closely as we all did, Indiana outside of Siakam did not hit contested shots. They, not at all. They didn't have to, but when they had to shoot a contested shot, they didn't. That's what made what Brunson did so impressive. Every shot he was taking was contested. It was off a dribble, off of a screen, through two guys, and then pull up for three or get in the paint against a taller player. It was just nonstop. The Pacers found a way to just get open look after open look because of Nick defensive lapses. I don't see OKC doing that. I think Carlisle's a hell of a coach. I think he'll do a good job trying to keep it competitive, but I think it's a sweep. G?
I think it's a sweep also. I think the OKC defense is the difference. I think Hartenstein and Holmgren wind up taking Siakam completely out of his game for a little bit, which throws the whole offense off. And I think they have enough defense to really slow them down. And once you slow Indiana down, them trying to find shots and them trying to play a half-court game, not getting anything off the fast break, I think that's a recipe for disaster for Indiana. I think OKC wins this very easily, to be honest.
And here's what's scary. When you look at OKC, Shai is 26, Williams is 24, Holmgren is 23, the core. They have 13 first-round picks in the next 7 years. I mean, if this is not a dynasty in the making, then Sam Presti has done something wrong. If they don't win multiple championships in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And that home court is really intense. It's right on top of the court. It's got like more of a college atmosphere than a pro atmosphere. And not that Indiana doesn't get loud or the Garden doesn't get loud, but that's like really like college level type of intensity.
Yeah.
Where everybody's wearing the same color and doing all their stupid little things. But you know what? It's gonna give them an edge.
There's nothing else in OKC to do than
that's it. You know, you sit there and you do that basically, and then you go and you look at your cows and make sure everybody's okay. I don't know. What are you gonna do?
Okay. NHL, the Stanley Cup Finals have started tonight. Florida and Edmonton at the moment. Florida leads 2-1 at the end of the first. I believe that's where we are.
Yep.
Darren, who do you like?
Well, we know who you like, right? And so every series, we say that the edge in goal goes against Skinner. And every series, Skinner has played well. Tonight, he's given up 2 goals on 5 shots. I don't think either was his fault, by the way. But again, Bob would get the edge by name. But I don't think we can any longer discount Skinner in the playoffs. It's almost like he's Giancarlo Stanton of hockey goaltenders, where he is great in the postseason. This is simple. This is the speed and skill of Edmonton versus the forecheck and physicality of Florida. That's what it comes down to.
Yep.
Not that Edmonton doesn't have some physicality, not that Florida doesn't have some speed, but the overall forecheck and physicality of Florida against that speed and that skill of Edmonton. You know, listen, last year Florida won it in 7. They're going to do it again in 7. I'm going to take Florida in 7. I think it's going to be a really good series. I think it's 2 really evenly matched teams. Edmonton's been great after the first 2 games against LA. They've been outstanding. Florida's only gotten better as the playoffs have gone on. They've played a lot of tough teams too. So I'm taking Florida, but I think it's really, really close. Go either way. Kev?
Yeah,
I think, you know, the loss of Zach Hyman for the Oilers hurts him.
I hate that guy.
Is there an Edmonton Oiler you like?
No, but I really hate Zach Hyman. I mean, he's like one of those guys I really dislike.
But, you know, all your points you made, last year this was a Stanley Cup matchup. It won 7 games. There's no reason to not expect this to go 7 games also. I think because Edmonton is home for Game 7, I think for the first time since 1993, a Canadian team will take home the Stanley Cup. I'll take Edmonton in 7.
By the way, only the second rematch in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
And 12th all time. You got to remember at one point there was only 6 teams in the league, so it was a little bit more commonplace. Sorry. G.
So is that going back before Edmonton and the Islanders?
It goes right back before the Edmonton Islander rematch. Yes. Okay. 40 years goes back. So it's only been one other time since that Edmonton Islander and this. And I don't know what that other matchup was. I really don't remember.
So Edmonton in 7 is Kevin's pick. Florida in 6 is Darren's pick.
Seven.
I think Edmonton is going to play very well. I don't think they've shown it yet, but I think they're going to play very well. I'm taking Edmonton in 5. I think Florida gets a game, but unlike last year, I don't think this goes long. I think once Edmonton gets rolling, and we've seen this the whole playoffs, once they get rolling or they get a bad game out of this system, they are just rocking and rolling the rest of the series. I'm taking Edmonton in 5.
Hey, listen, if one team's going to blow out the other, you can see it being both teams are excellent, though, so it should be pretty good. Okay. And the Rats scored the go-ahead goal here so far in Game 1. Marchand, I don't like him. I don't like either one of these teams that much. I like Tkachuk, but I don't like anybody else.
And thanks to Alexander Barkov, this is now the 45th consecutive Stanley Cup final that has a former or future teammate of Jaromir Jagr in the series.
Going back to his third straight Selke trophy. You know, very exciting stuff.
1980, Brian Trottier started that streak. He was a future teammate of Jagr. And every year since 1980, a teammate of Jaromir Jagr has been in the Stanley Cup Finals. That shows you how long Jagr played for.
That is crazy.
All right, let's move over to baseball. So, for today, Yankees at 37-22. 6.5 game lead in the East. Mets 38-23, 8-2 their last 10, half game up on Philly. Everybody else in that division is way out of it at this point. They're at least nine and a half games out in the rest of the NL East. Kev, let's start it with some Mets talk.
Well, the Mets over the weekend did what they had to. They swept the Rockies. You know, after taking, and let's face it, a week and a half ago, you looked at that schedule with the White Sox and Rockies, you said, minimum, you have to be 5-1, and that's what they did. Not impressively done, but you know what? It's baseball. You win the damn game that's on your schedule, and that's what they did. And then they go out to L.A., back-to-back extra inning games, and they've won one and lost one. Two more to go before they wrap up with the Dodgers, so at least they're showing they took 2 out of 3 at Citi Field a couple weeks ago, and now they've split the first 2 at Dodger Stadium, so they're showing no fear of the Dodgers. They're showing they can pitch to Ohtani. You know, I mean, as much as anybody has so far. And, you know, the big thing is, you know, I won't get into all the advanced stats, but all of a sudden Juan Soto, you know, has got 3 home runs in the last 4 games. He's got 5 straight games with an extra base hit, starting to hit the ball better. And you can see body language at the plate. He's starting to get more and more looking like Juan Soto. And if he starts to get hot, that just makes his team so much better.
Absolutely.
And then that's my Mets point. You know, they've got that, and they go to Colorado this weekend. And again, I know it's the red hot Colorado Rockies. We can talk about that in a second, but you know, another chance. You can't come off the Dodgers series with any sort of letdown. You have to go into Colorado and again, at least win the series.
Mm-hmm. The Vientos injury. I know they brought up Mauricio, but thoughts?
It hurts to some degree. As much as I root for Vientos, you know, he's really this year, he's taking a step back defensively. I mean, he looks like a butcher at third base. Brett Beatty looks like Brooks Robinson compared to Mark Vientos. I mean, no, Beatty makes a routine play that, you know, you'd sit there and watch him make the play, and you just cringe and you go, I don't know if Vientos would have made that play. And the fact that Beatty is at least hitting as well, you know, I think they'll survive the setback there. Mauricio, let's see what he does up here. You know, he was scorching hot down in AAA. A little sooner, I think, than they wanted to bring him up. You know, after a year off. You know, it's only been about, you know, 20 games or so between all three levels of the minors. But, you know, they'll mix and match him in there as well. They're not going to play him every day yet.
No, but it's good to see him up.
Yep.
And yeah. They just got to get Vientos' back going because he was so big down the stretch.
Oh, he was so big last year. Yep.
Okay. Darren, let's move to the Yankees. Luke Weaver, 46 weeks. Not good.
And Dominguez, day to day. So, quick stat. Because, you know, Saturday night I was all excited about the Knicks and the Yankees playing the Dodgers. So I had the two TVs up, you know. New York City, first city to ever have an NBA team and an MLB team lose by 15-plus points or runs on the same night. Nice job, boys. Thanks for making my Saturday night that special. Anyway. Yeah, so the Yankees, listen, they're going to lose tonight. Most likely down 4-0 in the eighth to the Guardians right now. The Weaver loss obviously hurts. You know, Dominguez, you want to get him back out there as well. LeMahieu's actually been hitting since he came back. Sorry, Gino, but he has been. Thing about the Yanks right now is, you know, blew game one of the Dodgers series. Should have had it, much like the Mets should have won their second game against the Dodgers last night. Diaz blew it. The Yankees blew their game as well. They were up 5-2 and kind of imploded. Well,
last night was Brazoban.
Yeah. Diaz the night before, Brazoban last night.
Yep.
And then they lost the fly ball in the outfield. Nimmo had it
turned the wrong way
and lost it in the 10th. But you know, right now it's going to come down to, you know, this team getting a little bit more consistency at the plate. They're getting shut out tonight. That's something that can't happen for this team. They have to score runs. Devin Williams got back into the closer role last night. Gave up a run. Made you feel really good. Made you feel real secure as a Yankee fan with that right away. But we'll see what we're able to get. Again, Rodon's been terrific. Fried has been outstanding outside of the last Dodgers start, and you really can't get mad at him for that. You know, Judge is still Judge, and Goldschmidt is still Goldschmidt. And, you know, if they can get just a little bit more timely hitting from other players, they're going to be just fine. They hold a nice lead in the division. Long way to go, obviously. Stanton, you know, don't know if he's going for a rehab assignment. Don't know if he's not. Boone was non-committal today about that. Leads me to believe that they're not rushing him back. And why would you? You just need him for October. You're not really in a hurry to get him back now. You know, that's really the story of the Yankees right now. The one thing I would say also is and it's really more of a Met thing, but it's about the Yankees from the history. So, you know, June 2nd was the anniversary of the headache, the Wally Pipp headache. So maybe Mauricio takes this job at third base and never looks back. I mean, if you remember, I mean, the old story goes, I mean, you know about the headache. Pip was the guy that went to Miller Huggins saying, you got to sign this kid out of Columbia. So Pip basically had them sign Gehrig. Gehrig then never gave up the spot for 2,130 games. And Pip got traded the next year. And Pip was kind of a known power hitter at the time. It wasn't like he was a bad player. So let's see if Mauricio can do that. That'll be really interesting. But, yeah, I mean, Yankees are going to have to win the rubber game tomorrow night.
So the one thing the Weaver injury does is give the opportunity to Devin Williams to basically reclaim this role, to show that he should be the closer, that he is the closer. I like it. I hope he succeeds. We didn't see it last. I mean, he got the save last night, but he was shaky. Hopefully he gets over whatever he needs to get over, because what we've seen in the past from this guy is a dominant closer. You know, he is a dominant closer. Not sure what's going on with him right now. You brought up LeMahieu. So my point on LeMahieu right now will be I'm okay with him. You know why? He's playing second base where he belongs. Goldschmidt's playing first. Chisholm's back playing third. He's playing second base. If he plays second base, I can live with him. I do not want him at first. I do not want him at third. He has no power. He doesn't have the power enough to play either of those positions. So I will give him the break. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Hopefully he plays well. So far, he's looked pretty good since he's come back from the injury. You know, going around the rest of baseball, so, you know, the Central divisions, all of a sudden the top teams have a 5 and 6 game lead. And I'm talking about the Tigers and the Cubs And usually those divisions kind of, if there is a big lead, it kind of goes into, you know, July, August. So the Tigers to be up 6, the Cubs to be up 5 at this point to me is huge. You know what I mean, Darren?
Yeah, the Tigers are the first team to get to 40 wins.
Yep.
The AL Central has 4 teams with winning records. It's not like the other teams are laying down.
Oh, no, no. I agree.
And, they're all playing well. It's just the Tigers are playing outstanding. And Skubal has, he's become the best pitcher in baseball.
So
there's even a debate right now.
So we are at June 4th. We just started June. Plenty of baseball to take place. Way plenty. But at this point, if I told you that Skubal's going to win the AL Cy Young, Judge's going to win the AL MVP, and Ohtani's going to win the NL MVP, I don't even know what's going to happen between now and the end of the season that's going to change that fact unless one of them goes down. I mean, I haven't seen this. I mean, Judge and Ohtani basically are all over the stat categories. It's crazy. Skubal, which I actually just looked at because I knew his numbers were fantastic, but 75 innings, he has 99 strikeouts and 7 walks through 95 through 75 innings. That's unbelievable right now.
That's Greg Maddux type numbers back.
Oh, absolutely. Walks. Absolutely. 2.26 ERA. I was like, wow, this is like unbelievable stuff. So just a couple of my points. You guys have anything on baseball?
I got about 2 or 3 things. You got something, Kev?
I've got some little stats too, but you go ahead.
Okay, Kev, lead the way.
All right. Saturday night, Washington Nationals against Arizona Diamondbacks. Washington's first inning. Hit by pitch, single, double, double. Hit by pitch, single, double, double. Pitching change, double. Hit by pitch, single. Nate Lowe finally struck out. First out came when the Nationals were up 9-0. Great, great, great performance by Pfat.
Yeah.
0 innings, 6 hits, 8 runs, 2 hits by pitch.
It's crazy.
Couple other things. Unfortunately, in some ways, they've won 3 in a row for the Rockies to get their first sweep since May of 2024. Between May 2nd and June 1st. You have that one too?
Yeah.
The Colorado Rockies had 3 wins. Scotty Scheffler had 3 wins. this weekend at Fenway, the Anaheim Angels hit 3 home runs in the first inning at Fenway Park. First time since the ballpark opened in 1912 that had ever happened.
Wow.
One of those things. You never know what's going to happen in baseball. And Red Sox, again, they were playing against the Brewers. Red Sox catcher Connor Wong was up at bat, and they put up this thing. Connor Wong's stepfather, Matt Macy, earned his only Major League Baseball save in 93 as a Brewer, stranding Seattle's Brian Turang at second base. So not only did his father get his first save for the Brewers, but the guy he stranded is the father of course, their current second baseman, Brian Turang. And, those were just the funny things I saw in post over the weekend or the past week. Darren, I think you may have a couple other just
couple funny quick sidebars. Things. So this week, O'Neill Cruz hit the hardest hit ball ever by StatCast, 122.9 miles an hour, right? So since they've been taking the stat on hardest hit balls, only 2 guys have the top 6. Okay, O'Neill Cruz at 122.9, O'Neill Cruz at 122.4, Giancarlo Stanton at 122.2, Giancarlo Stanton at 122.2 again, Giancarlo Stanton at 121.7, and O'Neill Cruz at 121.5. So 2 guys have really dominated the hardest velocity after making contact, which is pretty impressive to me. Just a quick stat. In baseball, only 1 player has ever had a 300 average, 300 home runs, 300 stolen bases, and 3,000 hits. You guys know who he was?
It's not Tony Gwynn.
It is not Tony Gwynn. I didn't give you a Tony Gwynn stat.
Wait, one more time? Cruz
did finally pass him. It is Willie Mays.
Willie Mays.
Willie Mays,
yeah.
300 average, 300 homers, 300 stolen bases, 3,000 hits. And just a quick thing on Eric the Red. Remember another guy, when we took there and talk about those guys in the 80s that were going to be stars, like Strawberry and Gooden, what we think about here in New York. Eric Davis was that guy in Cincinnati, too, and he was awesome. People forget how great a start of a career he had. Through his first 6 years, he had the same amount of home runs, stolen bases as Barry Bonds, and played 230 less games.
Wow.
Wasn't he like 48, 50 one year?
He was something ridiculous like that. Because he's a guy that looked like he was earmarked for a Hall of Famer as well, and then things just kind of fell off for him too. But in 230 less games, he had the same number of homers and ribbies. I thought that was an impressive stat. That's what I got in baseball, guys.
Wow.
And today, just reading this, Zidane Raffaella, the shortest walk-off home run in history, according to the StatCast, wrapped it around the pesky pole 308 feet to get the walk-off home run. That's a pop fly out in every other ballpark and probably a few Little League ballparks that we go to, too.
It could very easily be.
I just looked it up, Darren. So in 1986, Davis had 27 home runs and 80 stolen bases. And then the following year, he had 37 home runs and 50 stolen bases. So
he was such a good player. He sometimes gets forgotten about because Junior became like that Reds guy that we all think of. But Eric Davis, outside of taking a right hand from Ray Knight, was a really, really good ball player.
Sometimes
you think back Nasty Boys more than you think of Eric Davis. There's a lot of different things that you think about, but he had a great start to his career, much like Strawberry, much like Gooden, and a bunch of other stars.
All right, before we go to Belmont, let's go around the world of sports. Who's got something?
I have some college baseball. You want to go first with it, Kev, or you want me to do it?
Go ahead.
Okay, so tournament's down to 16 from 64. It's the same bracket style as Kevin showed us before on his sheet of paper. Basically, what happens is that it's a double elimination tournament. So what you have is 4-1 seeds, 4-2 seeds, 4-3 seeds, and 4-4 seeds in every bracket. And, you know, once you lose two games, you're out. So if you – generally, it's always going to go six games in each bracket. Every now and then, you get the exciting game seven. And we had six of those this year. So some interesting things happened. For the first time since 2015, the number one overall seed did not advance to play in the Super Regionals, okay, which is the next round, which is the round of 16. And actually, for the first time ever, the number one overall seed did not make it to the final of their own regional. They got knocked out by Wright State. Vanderbilt was the one seed. Texas, the two seed, also knocked out. So the bracket actually stays the same. So when you break it down to the next round, this team that was supposed to be one is supposed to play the team that was supposed to be 16, the same brackets, should have been Vandy versus Southern Miss, but instead we get Louisville versus Miami.
Miami was a three in that little bracket.
And they were. UT San Antonio, who got by Texas, beat them twice. They take the two side against UCLA, who was the 15. The 3-14 stayed in tow. So that's Arkansas and Tennessee, and they've had some battles and some bad blood over the years. 4-13 also stayed in tow. Auburn and Coastal Carolina. I'm going to get back to Coastal Carolina in a little bit. 5 was North Carolina. They stayed and kept it going. The 12 was Arizona. They got through the Oregon bracket. Oregon, who was the number one seed, finished last in their regional. So they did not do anything. They were the 12 overall. 6 LSU plays West Virginia. West Virginia actually beat Kentucky to get through, and they were the 3 in their bracket, and Clemson was supposed to be the highest seed there, so Kevin is happy that Clemson gets knocked out. The next one is Duke gets the home game in the Super Regional against Murray State. It was supposed to be Georgia and Ole Miss, but it didn't happen that way. And then the 8-9 stayed until 2, which would be a great series, Oregon State and Florida State. So what happens now is it's a best of 3. Three-game series at the higher seed remaining, so to speak, or Duke got it over Murray State, to be honest. And I believe it's Louisville got it over Miami. So those would be the matchups that go on. A couple of interesting things that happened in the first round. The Florida coach, I'm blanking on his name right now, made a spectacle of himself by yelling at the Coastal Carolina assistant AD and the grounds crew because they moved the game an hour. Acted like a complete buffoon, started going off on the Coastal Carolina assistant AD. What are you doing? Grow up. Stop being an ass. I hate these people that act like they have to act like babies. And then another one, the Wake coach got caught calling a Tennessee player a homophobic slur. on camera. So there's a lot of apologies. And the kid he called a homophobic slur to hit a two-run homer on the next during his next at-bat.
What was the homophobic slur?
You could kind of guess. I'm not going to go into it right now. So we had a little bit of drama. The one thing is, this is really exciting baseball if you actually get to sit there and watch it. A lot of offense. But then you get East Carolina, Coastal Carolina, which is a 1-0 win for Coastal on a run in the eighth. So yeah. Anything can happen, but the aluminum bats, balls carry relatively well. You know, the crowds get really into it. The Super Regional should be fun. They're all fighting to get themselves to Charles Schwab Field. It used to be Rosenblatt Stadium back when I was a kid. Now it's Charles Schwab Field in Omaha. College baseball. It's a similar bracket. You can fill it out just like you would your NCAA basketball bracket, only nobody does it. Kev, anything to add to college baseball?
Yeah, I mean, the tradition, I mean, since 1950, they've been playing the College World Series in Omaha. So it's a great tradition there. And I tell you, you know, when you get to these regionals and, you know, you take a look at a team like Oregon State that gets through, they lose their first game to St. Mary's. And all of a sudden, every game is must win at that point.
Yep. Next loss and they're out.
One loss and they're out. I mean, you play basically it's a game Thursday, game Friday. Yep. Eliminate 16 from the double elimination. Saturday, those 1-1 teams play for, you know, losers out, the winner goes on. They play basically a doubleheader against the undefeated team there. And if you wind up winning that game, then you go for another rematch, you know, to try and knock off. I mean, you know, some of these teams are playing 5 games in 4 days.
And the pitching staff feel it. You have guys at the back of the staff that has to come in and pitch in big spots. 19-year-old freshman with ERAs over 5. 18-year-old freshman with ERAs over 5 that have to come in a big spot. With the crowd bearing on them, it's pretty cool. Oregon State, just as the reference that you made, I mean, they blew out USC in those last 2 games. Yeah. They didn't even make them competitive. USC, who had was undefeated going in to they won, they were the winner.
They won the first two.
Yeah, Oregon State just bombed them in the last two.
But like you said, you've got the games 20-13, 15-14, and then like I said, you do have the occasional 1-0 barn burners between Eastern and Coastal Carolina.
Absolutely. You get some good stuff.
Yep.
One last point on college baseball. The LSU Shreveport Pilots, okay?
Yes.
They finished 59-0, 30-0 in conference, 8 wins by 15-plus runs, had a .361 batting average, .238 ERA, a .192 batting average against, longest winning streak in baseball history, and yes, they are the NAIA College baseball champions. 59-0.
I don't care what level it is. 59 wins in a row.
Imagine your team hits 361. Your team hits 361 and your opponent hits 192. You're going to win a lot of games. I mean,
you don't get one random game where a couple of errors, you know, the pitcher throws a great game and you lose 3-2.
This is one of those things.
I think you would go 59-0.
This is the kind of crap on Kevin's 50 wins, 50 losses, and whatever the other. This is like, you know, you would think that you have, 20 wins, 20 losses, and you figure out what the other 19 games are. Yeah. Nope. This is 59-0. And then just one last point, and this is Women's College World Series. Had a couple of interesting things happen, okay? First and foremost, in a quarterfinal matchup, Tennessee beats UCLA, okay? UCLA's down to their final out. They hit a 2-run home run to tie the game in the top of the 7th. As the runner is running around the bases, and I'm trying to find her name, Megan Grant, she jumps into the pile, misses home plate. Her teammate pushes her back on the plate so she touches it. The on-deck hitter, which was a girl named Alexis Ramirez, after a 13-minute review, the umpires indicate that Grant did miss home plate, but it is not reviewable. And the runner
Article G of Rule 48.
Yep, absolutely. So it was Article G. You're 100% right. And the Appendix G. According to Appendix G, the umpire, that's not reviewable. Tennessee did win in the bottom of that inning, okay? And then another point, an epic game that brought an end to an epic run in NCAA Women's College World Series. Number 12, Texas Tech defeated number 2, Oklahoma 3-2 in the semifinal round on Monday in Oklahoma City to advance to the championship series against Texas, okay? Thrilling game. The Oklahoma loss ended a historic streak of 9 consecutive appearances in the World Series final, including championships in each of the last 4 years. And the team that defeated the dynastic powerhouse continues its inspired run as they take on Texas. So Texas Tech had not been there before. They end a team that had won four in a row and been to the championship game 9 years in a row. So good stuff. But a lot of drama in this too. A lot of last inning type stuff in the softball. It was pretty cool. Pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, Texas Tech is a player, Nigeri Kennedy.
Yeah, she drove in the game winner.
Yeah, she's a pitcher. 30 plus wins, an ERA under one, fastball 70 miles an hour plus in softball, which is equivalent, you know, when you extrapolate distance and all, it's like 105 mile an hour fastball in baseball.
Yeah, that's the Tennessee girl that throws 79, that just shows you how hard that is.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on her name, but yeah.
And she also hit 11 home runs this year. She makes $1 million in NIL money. And $50,000 for living expenses and $24 to represent her collegiate number. That's your tip money. But, wow. You know, even softball players can make $1 million in NIL money.
Crazy stuff, man.
Two more quick things, not in softball or baseball, college hoops. Cooper Flagg, do you know how much money he made in NIL last year combined with all his endorsements?
A few million, 4 or 5 million.
How about 28?
28
million dollars freshman year at Duke. And last thing is a college football point before we get to the Belmont. The College Football Hall of Fame is lowering the career win percentage for coaches from 60% to 59.5% to allow the late, great Mike Leach, who I love, to be inducted. He will join the Hall of Fame in 2027. Great offensive mind, great personality, and I think it was a really nice gesture for the for the college football to do that and get him into the Hall of Fame because he did do a lot of revolutionary things and was funny as hell on the sideline. And that's what I had around the world of sports before we get into the Belmont, G. Anything else for you, Kev?
Yeah, French Open is going on. We're in the second week. We're into the semifinals. On the women's side, a couple regular names going into the finals or semifinals here. On the one side, you've got Sabalenka versus Swiatek. Those are names you're all familiar with. Mm-hmm. On the other side is Coco Gauff, the last American hope. She's playing, of course, Lois Boisson, who everybody expected to be there. She got a wild card entry. She was ranked 1,500th or something in the world. She's a French woman, and they gave her a wild card. She's the first wild card to advance to the semifinals in 50 years.
That's awesome.
Doing this. So she's made an incredible run. She's got the crowd behind her, and that's what Coco's got to deal with in the semifinals.
Wow.
On the men's side, I think you may have heard of some of these names. One side, you've got Sinner versus Djokovic.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible that Djokovic is still doing this. And that's then the other side is Alcaraz. So, you know, typical name. And the eighth seed, Lorenzo Musetti from Italy.
Yep.
The fact that this guy is eighth in the world, you know, you look at his stats, he's won two tournaments in his life. Both were in 2022. And yet he's still number eight in the world.
So many people go up and down in the men's rankings. It's crazy.
Up and down. I mean, it's so top heavy with, you know, right now with Sinner, Alcaraz, and Djokovic, that there's no room for anybody else, it feels like.
And it's been top heavy for the last 25 years, you know.
Yeah.
With the other guys, with Federer and with Nadal up there as well. It's been crazy.
Yeah. So, like I said, 6 of the 8 names in the semifinals are very well known. If you follow tennis, the other two, maybe a little less. Well, one's definitely unknown.
Absolutely.
And that's the French Open for you in 62 seconds, I think.
All right.
There we go.
So we will move to the third leg of the Triple Crown. It is the Belmont Stakes, currently being held at Saratoga. The 157th running of the Belmont Stakes. That's right. Started back in 1867. Because it's at Saratoga, because they're doing construction out on Long Island, it is only a mile and a quarter, not a mile and a half. 8 horses in the field. We can't have a Triple Crown because we know that Sovereignty won the Derby, Journalism won the Preakness, so there is no Triple Crown winner. Darren, let's start it off with Saratoga.
Eight horse field. All right. I'm going to start them all off with the one Hill Road, dead closer, Chad Brown, Irad Ortiz, 10 to one opening line there. Number two, Sovereignty, the Derby winner, sat out the Preakness, a little bit more rested. Another closer, 2-1 right now. You got Mott and Alvarado on top. The three is Rodriguez, who hasn't run since the Wood, got scratched the day before the Derby, if you remember. Early speed horse, one of two speed horses in the race. You got Bobby Baffert, you got Mike Smith, 6-1, early speed. Four is Uncaged, mid-pack horse, got Pletcher and Saiz. Mike Rapoli's horse just spent the money because he has the money to spend. This horse does not belong here. 30-1 morning line, it will not go off that close. The five is Crudo, another Pletcher horse with Johnny Velasquez aboard, 15-1. This is the other speed horse in the race. The only chance of keeping the race honest is the two speed horses going out there. The number six, we have Baeza, who, as you remember in the Derby, came storming down the center of the track. You got John Sherrison, Flavian Pratt, 4-1. This is a mid-pack horse. The seven is Journalism. You get McCarthy and Rispoli for the third time. Only horse running in all three legs. 8-5, mid-pack horse again, Tactical Speed. And the eight, Heart of Honor. You get the Osborne-Osborne combination, father and daughter again. Horse finished fifth in the Preakness. Dead closer as well is going to need pace. So with all that being said, it's going to be, you know, Rodriguez and Crudo to see who goes out there early. You're gonna see some pressing from, you know, not really pressing, but Journalism and Baeza, I think, will be relatively close. Uncaged right there a little bit with them, and Sovereignty a little bit further back. Hill Road and Heart of Honor coming from the grandstands. So, Kev, here's the eight-horse field. Who's going to win the third leg in the 10 furlong, just to make Gino happy? Belmont Stakes.
I missed the 12 furlong.
We're back to 10, baby.
Back to 10. You know, you throw out Heart of Honor. Uncaged, if the weather is bad and the track gets muddy, both of his wins have been in the mud.
Very true.
Son of Curlin. So, you know, there's something going for him, but, you know, and like I said,
not against any kind of competition in either one of those races.
The Mike Rapoli horse, Holy Cross, that's why I wanted to mention him.
Absolutely.
Like I said, Crudo's going to get out there, keep it honest with Rodriguez. Son of Justify, Crudo. He was gearing up for this race. His prep was at Sir Barton Stakes.
Yeah, he won away. You're right.
He won by 7.5, drawing away.
Hill Road won the Peter Pan, by the way, for those that don't know who that horse is.
Yep. And last year he was third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, if you want to go back that far. So he does have some pedigree in him.
Uncaged was unplaced in the Peter Pan. Did not finish in the top five.
That's right. <Yeah. laughs> But again, you know, you're looking at I'm rooting for Journalism because he's the one that's running all three. He's the best horse in the field, I think. You know, the second place in the Derby, he was the best horse. He had the terrible trip. Sovereignty had the terrific trip to get him. But I think the fact that this is now his third race in 5 weeks puts him at a disadvantage. You've got Sovereignty and Baeza with a good chance with some rest. Baeza, you know, his mom, the mare, Puka, out of Big Brown. Puka was the mom last year's Belmont winner, Dornock. So there is some connection there. And Puka also bred 2023 Kentucky Derby winner Mage. So the pedigree is there. Got rest. He's a stalker. Ran well. I think, like I say, going back to Sovereignty, just had the ideal trip in the Derby. Journalism's going to be tired. I think Baeza pulls this one off.
I'm going to take
Baeza on top. I think he's going to get Journalism at the wire, and Sovereignty is going to close for third and pass all the tired horses. So I'm going to go 6-7-2.
All right.
Gino threw his hands up.
Apparently is in a similar mindset to you. Go ahead, G.
I like Baeza to win this race. Unlike Kev, though, I'm gonna throw Rodriguez in there somewhere.
You liked him in the Derby.
I liked him in the Derby. He got scratched. I'm going Baeza one. I'll probably take three horses for the two and the three spot. I'll probably put Journalism and Sovereignty and Rodriguez in there and hope Baeza wins. Rodriguez comes in second and the ticket's actually a pretty good ticket.
Yep.
To knock out the two favorites off the top two spots. I mean, if the pressure, I feel like when we don't have anyone with a chance for the third leg, like the whole race, it still winds up being a good race, but without that extra excitement of a possible triple crown, it comes down a notch. I think because it's in Saratoga last year, this year, and actually next year too, right, Darren? 3 years?
They said it was going to be two, but I think it's going to be three. They don't look anywhere close.
Yeah, I mean, I think it builds it up a little bit because it's not usually at Saratoga, and we know how great that place is. But I'm taking Baeza. Darren?
Okay, so yeah, I've been on journalism for about 4 months now. I'm not going off here. I'm going to take journalism to win this race again. I'm going to put the 7 on top. I think that Sovereignty is going to run second, and I think Hill Road's going to finish third in this one. I'm going to go 7-2-1.
You like the one, huh?
I like the one as to pass a tiring Baeza. Baeza has been excellent. Pratt's a great jockey. I'm not trying to take it away. And this is a great – listen, usually I agree with you 100% on the fact that it loses steam because it's not a triple crown. It certainly does lose a little. But this is a race I'm actually looking forward to. The top three finishes in the Derby – in a sloppy race, are going at each other again. The only disadvantage in the race is journalism had a run 3 weeks ago. The others have the 5-week rest. I think that the speed horses will get caught up and knocked out. But the thing is, Gino, that your Rodriguez or Crudo, if one of those two can get to the front and the other horse lets them kind of control the race and they go out in 23 and change, maybe even 24, you could see one of these horses stealing the race and the closer's really not having a shot.
Yeah.
That's what has to happen for them to win. And for everybody else that's a runner to win, they need the two of them to go out there together and put out honest fractions. But I'm going to take the 7 on top. Let's see how it goes.
But if those two go out and let's say somebody like Uncaged, who's usually a stalker, is close enough to push them so that they do run 23-1 rather than 24. That might set it up for all the closers.
It just depends on if Uncaged gets out and honestly what Saez wants to do with him. I mean, you know, and Pletcher decide to do with him. But you're right. He's the horse that doesn't belong when you look at
the
histories. You know, even the two wins in the slop were not against great competition. It's not like this horse has beaten anybody. But you're right. And everything I'm reading is that Baeza is going to be closer to the pace than he was in the Derby. And that's important. And Sovereignty will not be the dead closer. Hill Road will be the horse coming from the rafters. So we're going to see what happens here.
It's 8 horses instead of 22. That helps a lot.
Well, Sovereignty had, like you said, perfect trip.
Yeah.
Journalism did not necessarily. Baeza did not necessarily. So now Journalism beat Baeza head-to-head the last two times they've run against each other, in the Santa Anita and in the Derby. Now we're going to see if he's able to hold them off again in this one, which is that stretch that seems like it lasts for freaking ever, just like the Belmont. Both of these stretches, there's something comparable about it, even though the track's smaller, because the stretches just don't end on these two tracks. They just don't, especially when you have the horse in the lead. It just, that line never comes.
And again, this could be a case where Journalism is the best horse in this field.
Yeah, no doubt.
But the third race in 5 weeks, unlike anybody else in the field, I think is a difference.
Now, and you got great trainers, you got great jockeys in this race too.
Yeah,
all of these horses have a shot. The only one that a little bit more unknown is the Osborne combination. But we'll see what happens.
Yep.
Any other closing points, boys, before we wrap this show up?
No.
Nope.
All right, we are under an hour with the Sports Kings from Queens. Darren here with Kevin here with Gino. Talk about the wonderful, wild, and wacky world of sports. A wacky world where you can miss home plate, have a 13-minute review, and nothing happens. Please download the podcast anywhere you get a podcast, whether it be an Apple product, Spotify, TuneIn, whatever you like. We're putting a lot on social. Please like it. Please share it. Even if you don't like it anyway, and share it anyway. And without any further ado, may your sports be with you.
Open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors or design your own using our free garage door designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
We'll be right back.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.